You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And what it is, the president just signed the Stock Act, which is sort of watered down, but it's still a start at saying, I remember when Brian Barrett on this program first outed this. This was back 4 years ago, that he'd walked into a Republican congressman's office and there were staffers day trading on their computers using inside information that they had in Congress. And Democratic Congressman Brian Baird, who represented Southern Washington State at that time, he's no longer in Congress, he was horrified by this. He came on the air on our program. He talked about it. He talked about it anywhere he could. He proposed legislation to put it to an end. And now it's sort of at an end. This is a good start. Good start. I mean, it's something, right? And it was basically, the Republicans were basically shamed into going along with it. Because this was big stuff. I mean, Tom DeLay's office was really into this. Tom Coburn had this whole long debate with Lee Fong the other day, and who kind of ambushed him for a discussion and said, "Oh yeah, I even trade stock in the bathroom." I assume he was speaking facetiously. So anyhow, that happened. State after state is saying, "Let's drug test welfare recipients. Let's drug test unemployed people. Let's drug test anybody who wants food stamps. Let's punish working class and poor people. You're not making enough money to buy the food." There was a study out that came out today that showed, first of all, that if the minimum wage was adjusted to 1968 levels, it would be about $10 an hour. But even at that, if you work an entire year at the minimum wage, you earn just about enough money to buy health insurance for a family of four. Assuming you eat nothing for the entire year, assuming you consume no electricity or fuel, you don't drive a car, you don't live anywhere, that's it. All you can pay for is your health insurance. Meanwhile, more police brutality against students, this time yesterday in California. As many as 30 Santa Monica College students were pepper sprayed, including a small child. This was last night. They were attending a Board of Trustees meeting. And they were protesting a plan by the college to jack up the prices to attend college. And they started shouting, "Shame on you, shame on you." And the campus cops came out with a pepper spray right in the face. In fact, the spray from the pepper, so this was inside of a closed room. And so dozens of people were just, screaming and running out of the building, choking on this stuff. They called paramedics to the scene. Five of the students were treated for chemical exposure. Two others were taken to a nearby hospital for exposure to this chemical weapon. Our First Amendment right to assemble, protest, and speak freely is growing increasingly under attack in the United States as our nation is moving closer and closer to what looks like, at least when it comes to young people out in the streets, a police state. So what did these young people do to deserve a chemical attack by the cops? Absolutely nothing. They were exercising their right to peaceably assemble at a Board of Trustees meeting at their college. And when they protested against the college's plan to charge more money for classes, they were met with a face full of pepper spray. Just like those students at the University of California, Davis last year were doing nothing. They were sitting peacefully when they were doused with pepper spray, too, by campus police officers. Or the young women who were peacefully marching in the Occupy movement in New York City and then kettled in by New York Police Department cops whose association had taken a couple million dollars from Jamie Dimon, one of the big bankers, and then hit them in the face with pepper spray. These young people don't deserve this kind of treatment. So what's going on here? Why is it that young people around the nation are getting assaulted with chemical weapons for simply doing what patriotic Americans are supposed to do, organize peacefully and speak truth to power? Or perhaps a more important question, why have there been all these uses of pepper spray and tasers and batons and other beanbags, gun, so-called rubber bullets, rubber-coated bullets, against peaceful Occupy protesters, but none of it against armed Tea Party protesters. I mean, this is a Hippocratic, hypocritical, unequal response to two movements, and it's on clear display in the city of Tampa, Florida. You know where Tampa, you know where the Republican National Convention is going to be in August? Tampa. So the city's getting ready. They just passed a rule saying that if you show up with a water pistol, a mask, or a piece of string more than 6 inches long, you go to jail and get strip searched. But if you show up with a handgun, no problem. So if you're an Occupy protester wearing a Guy Fawkes mask, you're getting pepper sprayed and strip searched. But if you're a Tea Partier strapping a Colt 45 to your thigh, A-OK. This is bizarre. And this assault is pretty much exclusively going against the Occupy Wall Street folks. Young people calling for an end to corporate corruption of our government. On the other hand, largely older white Americans who have no problem with corporate power and are preaching, in fact, the destruction of large parts of our government and routinely arming themselves at demonstrations, their free speech rights are being defended by the police. They're not getting corralled in. They're not getting beaten with batons. They're not being pepper sprayed. They're not being arrested by the thousands. Well, they're all nice and orderly. You know, after all, the Koch brothers and multimillionaire lobbyists like Dick Armey are giving them million-dollar bus tours, expensive sound stages, high-profile speakers like Sarah Palin, renting hotel rooms for them and putting them up. But who's really defending the American way of life, and who's trying to tear it down here? Put aside for a moment the fact that the Tea Partiers routinely carry guns, and the big deal here is that they carry a bizarre ideology. They and their billionaire funders say that the government should play no role whatsoever in the welfare of its citizens, condemning millions of Americans to live in poverty and, without health care, to die alone in the streets. This Paul Ryan Republican, Ayn Rand, bizarre right-wing libertarian ideology that says the rich deserve even more tax cuts, even when those tax cuts force the layoff of firefighters, police officers, and teachers, is destroying America. It's an ideology that says corporate polluters like the Koch brothers should have free rein to dump toxic chemicals in our air and water. And the CDC and the EPA cut their funding. They shouldn't even be able to find out why cases of autism and asthma among young people are skyrocketing. This Paul Ryan Republican libertarian Ayn Rand bizarre ideology that is carried by the Tea Party, if fully implemented, would lead to the death of the United States as we know it. We would become Somalia. Whereas the Occupy movement simply wants to bring back what's already been tried and true in America, what's worked for almost a century, which arguably is what is conservative, right? Conservatives say, oh, don't change things. We go back to what works. We used to have regulations on Wall Street. We used to have fair taxes on the rich and corporations. We used to have a strong social safety net. We did not allow corporations and billionaires to corrupt our government. And guess what? We had the strongest period of growth in the history of this country from the 1940s to the 1980s. The occupiers are saying, we want that middle class back, please. And the Tea Partiers are saying, middle class, we don't need no stinking middle class. Tax cuts for the rich. Liberate the polluters. Do away with government regulation. So which movement should really be getting the pepper spray treatment from the police? The Occupy or the Tea Party? Well, frankly, I'll tell you, neither one should, because free speech is free speech. But the fact that occupiers around the country are facing this sort of constant brutality says something about the state of America right now and who or what is in power. It's always more dangerous to protest against things that the rich and powerful want. And right now, the rich and powerful in America want this ideology that's pushed by the Tea Party and its millionaire and billionaire donors. And that, the destroying Social Security, Medicare, Pell Grants, that is bad for America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we wake up the Tea Partiers? How do we take on the Tea Partiers? How do we push back against this crazy ideology? When you feel it kind of low, let me tell you where to go. Turn on the radio. Okay, so the Occupy movement, the best thing we've got going on right now in the United States, it's like the participants in the original Boston Tea Party in 1773. What the Occupy movement is protesting is corporate power and government corruption. In 1773, they marched down to the Boston Wharf and they threw $1 million in today's dollars, $1 million worth of tea into the harbor to protest the corporate power of the British East India Company and their ability to have corrupted the British government to give them the largest, what at that point in time was the biggest corporate tax break in history. Now, of course, they didn't have Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, but. And so they threw this tea in the harbor. That was the original Tea Party. It was a protest against corporate power and the ability of corporations to corrupt government. And that's what the occupiers are protesting. And what are the Tea Partiers protesting? They're protesting the fact that government can keep the Koch brothers' oil refineries or their paper mills from polluting water and air. Holy cow, we can't have that, can we? I mean, these young people are our best hope for saving the American middle class, and we need to get out there and occupy something. I'm telling you, this is just absolutely incredible. Samuel Chase, remember that name. Samuel Chase was a member of the United States Supreme Court in 1804. Actually, he'd been on the court for several years at that point. He was a Federalist, a high Federalist, which today you would call a Republican. Thomas Jefferson was the founder of the Democratic Republican Party, referred to on the Samuel Chase page over at Wikipedia as the Republican Party, because the conservatives and Republicans are constantly scrubbing Wikipedia for references like that. Let's turn Jefferson into a Republican. Well, he talked about Republican principles, and he referred to himself a few times as a Republican, but his name of his party was the Democratic Republican Party. They dropped the word Republican in the late 1820s, early 1830s. He was the founder of today's modern Democratic Party. You won't find that in the Samuel Chase page at Wikipedia, but in any case, this Supreme Court justice was so corrupt. He was deciding cases based on his own partisan perspective, based on politics. And Jefferson just was hysterical. I mean, this was right after the 1803 Marbury versus Madison decision when the Supreme Court said, oh, yeah, we got the right of judicial review. We can strike down laws passed by Congress. Where do you find that in the Constitution, says Jefferson? Oh, we just made it up, says John Marshall, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at the time and Jefferson's second cousin and arguably most bitter political enemy in the world. So Samuel Chase is using these powers and you know, to promote his partisan agenda, much like, you know, Clarence Thomas does. Hey, you know, let's help out Ginny here. She needs another couple $100,000 from the Koch brothers. Or let's see. Hell, let's help out the Koch brothers or the Federalist Society. Let's just show up at their fundraisers. Let's show up at their meetings where the billionaires pledge money to destroy Obama. Thomas, Scalia, Alito. Jefferson had it right. He went before he didn't go before Congress. He wrote a letter to several members of Congress asking that they impeach Samuel Chase, and they did. They impeached him in the House of Representatives, the same way Bill Clinton was impeached in the House of Representatives, the same way Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's vice president, was impeached in the House of Representatives. And just like all the other those other two examples I gave you, Chase was not convicted in the Senate, so he was not removed from office. He stayed on the Supreme Court. He died of a heart attack in 1811. But the point is, Jefferson said, enough of this. I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Impeach somebody. And I you've been hearing this rant. Those of you who have been listening to this program for the 9 years that we've been on the air have heard this many, many times. But it sure bears repeating now that we have what is arguably, certainly the most corrupt court in the history of the 20th century. And arguably the second or third most corrupt court in the history of the nation, this Roberts Court. Now look at this 5-4 strip search decision a couple of days ago. Judicial activism is broadly defined as a court striking down laws passed by the people, you know, for their own reasons, or making law, coming up with doctrines, inventing things out of whole cloth. Don't you think that local city officials for the city jails, county officials for the county jails, state officials for the state prisons, federal officials for federal jails, don't you think they should be able to decide who gets strip searched and who doesn't? I mean, in the strip search case that we had a couple of days ago here, you know, that the Supreme Court ruled, every jail has the right to strip search anybody anytime they want. It's not up to the court. It's not up to anybody except the cop who brings you into the guy running the jail or the cop at the jail. So if you're an Occupy protester and you get busted for jaywalking or loitering or just, hey, you know, a lot of them get busted and then released the day later with no charges at all. You get to get stripped naked and bend over and be humiliated in front of a bunch of cops poking at you and laughing at you. That's making law. That should be up to the people. This court is so corrupt. It's time to take a lesson from Thomas Jefferson and impeach these guys. Or at least a few of them. Like Scalia and Alito and Thomas. And Roberts as well for lying during his confirmation hearings.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So what do we do about the court? And how do you push back against the Tea Party? Why is the Tea Party not getting pepper sprayed? I don't get this. We'll be right back. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Al in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Al, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine. What's up?
Hey, I think what you just said was perfect. We need to occupy every imaginable thing that we can occupy. I think we should start taking pictures of bridges that are falling apart with our cell phones, and I think we should email them to our congressmen, to our senators. I think we have people power. If they can hit us with a record number of filibusters, we can hit them back with a record number of people.
Hmm. Great. That's a great statement and very eloquently done. Thank you, Al, very much. Very, very well said. Patty in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Nothing much, Tom. Hey, I just had a quick question. I wanted your take on H.R. 347.
Right.
I read the text, and I've heard what other people have to say about it. And I just want to hear what your take is on it.
My take on the bill that you're talking about, if I recall the number correctly, 437, was the one that extends or allows the federal government to establish areas that they say are basically free speech zones. These are areas, actually the opposite of free speech zones. These are areas where the government can say you can't protest here, and if you do, you get arrested. And the operational theory behind this is that, you know, when the president or a senator or whatever, somebody shows up, Gabby Giffords, that there can be some protection of that person. I think, though, that the theory, you know, is fine. In practice, I think it's going to have a chilling effect on free speech.
Okay.
Makes sense? I mean, I'm not a fan of this law. It was passed with a lot of Democrats and virtually unanimously on the Republican side. And I think it's because politicians are just scared after Gabby Giffords was shot and not to mention a long history of political assassinations in the United States, things like that. But I don't think that the people who put this thing together were thinking, okay, we'll use this to shut down the Occupy movement or the Tea Party movement or something like that.
Okay, Tom, well, I appreciate it.
But I think it could have that effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Patty, thanks a lot for the call. I would love to see this bill tested in court, and you know, we'll see where this one goes. Robert in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I'm on the conservative line, but I'm not conservative by any means. But I do have there's something about your views on judicial review that I don't understand.
Okay.
I'm thinking that of what James Fenimore Cooper said about his fear at the start of our country was that there could be a tyranny of the majority.
Yes.
And that the court system would provide a check on the legislature in that regard. Now, I noticed in
that wasn't just like Cooper. I mean that was that there's a long conservative history to that perspective. That was Alexander Hamilton's perspective. That was John Adams' perspective. That was the perspective of many of the high Federalists, certainly John Marshall and others. It was very much not the perspective of the Democratic Republicans, the Jeffersonians, the anti-Federalists.
Oh, thank you. I noticed in cases like we hear that voter suppression law in Wisconsin,
right,
and that was struck down by I forget what kind of a court, state or circuit court. And how about the one in California, the ban on gay marriage that was struck down by a circuit court, was it?
I think that was the ban on gay marriage, yes.
Yeah, that was struck down.
I was going to say the ban itself was promoted by the Mormon Church largely. But,
Yeah. So it was either a state or a federal circuit court.
Right, so the argument you're making is that occasionally when the judiciary strikes down a law, they get it right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's a tyranny of the majority in these cases.
Right.
In the case of Wisconsin, you have a hoodwinked, a snookered majority where the people thought they were voting for something else, and the candidate never said he was going to do these things, and then he went ahead and did them.
Yeah. No, I don't disagree in principle. In practice, though, well, actually, I do disagree in principle. Here's what you're really saying. What you're really saying is that the vast majority of the people can be fooled and their representatives can be fooled or corrupted, and therefore we need a small number of very wise, incorruptible people to hold them in check. And I would submit to you that, first of all, the vast majority of the people can be corrupted and fooled over the short term, but over the long term, it's not going to happen, number one. And number two, the small number of wise people who are going to hold them in check, those people are just as corruptible as the masses, and they are less answerable. As Thomas Jefferson said in his 1819, I think it was, letter to Spencer Roane, Patrick Henry's son-in-law, who was then a justice of the Virginia Supreme Court. He said, I'm paraphrasing now. I don't remember the exact language, but this is damn close. He said, power is absolute when it is unresponsive to the people. And the judges, he was speaking in the Supreme Court. He was talking, in fact, about the Marbury versus Madison case. And these judges are not elected by the people. And he said, over the short term, the phrase he used was, while the spirit of the people is up, they will not abuse this power. In other words, the Supreme Court in 1803 had taken this power to themselves to strike down laws. And, over the next 10, 15 years, they only used it once or twice. They were very, very wary of doing it because people were really upset about this. As I pointed out, in 1804, the next year, President Thomas Jefferson got Samuel Chase impeached, one of the Supreme Court justices, in large part because of his upset about this issue. But then then Jefferson says, and I encourage you to read this letter that he wrote to Spencer Roane. You can easily Google it, 1819 letter, Thomas Jefferson. He said, by this ruling, the Constitution has become a thing of wax to be molded in the hands of the judiciary, and they are the unelected branch. They're the least responsive to the will of the people. In another letter, I don't think it was to Roane, I think it was to Ben Rush, he made the comment, I am not of the opinion that we need to have the elite or the rich to protect our liberties. I'm an advocate of the mass of the people. He over and over and over again, Jefferson kept saying, you can trust the mass of the people. They can be fooled for the short period, but not for the long period. And so by arguing in favor of judicial review, what you're basically arguing is the same argument that was made by royalists, and is to this day in many countries, that you need to have wise elders who can keep a check on the impulses of the people. And I don't believe that. And I think that that's the main cleavage, frankly, between conservative and liberal thought over the last 500 years, that the Enlightenment that came about after Thomas Hobbes wrote Leviathan in 1634 and then in the 1674, I think it was, you had the Second Treatise on Government by John Locke, in which he talked about life, liberty, and property as inherent rights, and Jefferson cobbled into the Declaration of Independence. And then about 15 years later after that, you had Jean-Jacques Rousseau writing about the noble savage and the original state of man as they were starting to, you know, Europe was starting to explore North America and Africa and other lands and discovering people living in peace and you know, Aboriginal people, indigenous people living in peace. And Rousseau saying, you know, hey, it's possible for people to govern themselves. And that led right to, that was the Enlightenment. That kicked off the Enlightenment. And the primary idea of the Enlightenment, which is what was fostered the American Revolution and is the core concept at the heart of the United States of America, of the founding of the United States of America, and you will find it in the Declaration of Independence and in the Constitution, is that we the people can govern ourselves and that we don't need a king to hold us in check or to correct us when we go wrong. We will go wrong. We have gone wrong many times in the course of this country, but we don't want to give that kind of power to a group of people who are not elected and who are not answerable to us to screw things up, because they screw things up too. In 1856, the Supreme Court ruled in Dred Scott, that Dred Scott versus Sanford, that Dred Scott, this slave who had gone with his owner up to Wisconsin, I think it was, or Minnesota, and which was a free state at that time, and then his master brought him back to, you know, below the Mason-Dixon line, and Dred Scott claimed, hey, because I was up in a free state, I'm now a free man. And the Supreme Court ruled, no, sorry, you were a slave, and you will always be a slave because you're African American. In other words, they ruled that people were property. If that ruling had not happened, we probably wouldn't have had the Civil War. You know, in 1889 or 1898, what's the name of the case? Separate but equal, Plessy versus Ferguson. You know, the Supreme Court established literally 100 years, not literally, it was up until the 1954, more than a half century of legal apartheid in the United States. I mean, so the Supreme Court has done a lot of bad things over the years that, frankly, some of them would have been done by legislatures. Others wouldn't have been. So to every, you know, Brown versus Board or Roe v. Wade or, you know, overturning the Voter ID Acts, I would say there's just as many bad decisions by the court that involve judicial review, and that if we threw out judicial review like they do in the U.K., they have no judicial review in the U.K. The court, the Supreme Court in the U.K. cannot strike down laws. And I don't see that country going down in flames. In Canada, it is very, very tightly regulated. In Switzerland, the Supreme Court has no power of judicial review. They can advise Parliament, and Parliament can ignore them. In Canada, the Supreme Court can strike down laws, but Parliament and the Prime Minister can ignore their rulings, and have many, many times. So this is not something that we need, and this court, this Roberts Court, is devastating this country with it. Thanks for the call, Robert.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Help me educate a new generation of constitutional scholars. We're going to do it. We're going to do it. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Not a chance. Ain't going to happen. Amazing. Grace in Los Gatos, California. Hey, Grace, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Fine.
I'm trying to remain calm, but I'm actually been having a panic attack ever since I found out about the strip search law that these judges passed that will never face anything like that.
Right.
And I have been I'm sorry, I'm really nervous.
It's okay.
I've been a victim of sexual abuse, mm-hmm. and the thought of driving down the street and having a bad blinker that I could be hauled in and strip searched is extremely terrifying to me.
Well, first of all,
it's got to be for thousands of people.
I'm sure it is. First of all,
it's just triggering so many feelings and emotions that I haven't thought about in a long time.
I understand. And it's important to realize that the odds of your being in that situation are virtually zero. That typically people don't go to jail for bad blinkers or even for bad traffic violations. They pay a fine and that's it. And when they do go to jail, I mean, in my personal opinion, there were two dimensions to this legislation by the Supreme Court. And I use those words advisedly or intentionally. The court was saying, and probably correctly so, but I think it's the job of local legislatures to say this, that a jail has the right to control, you know, what goes in and out of the jail. And so if you're running a prison and some guy comes in, you know, with a switchblade strapped to the inside of his leg or, you know, something like that, you want to be able to know it. So that just kind of makes sense. On the other hand, I think that there was also an element of let's try to intimidate protesters.
Exactly.
And so because there's been so many people in the Occupy movement who have been sent to jail overnight, people here in Washington, D.C., regularly, they stand out in front of the White House. And you had the people who were protesting the XL pipeline, and over 100 of them got arrested and sent to jail. We should not have to fear our government. We should not have to fear that if we protest, we are going to be stripped naked and humiliated. And whether we have suffered from sexual violence or abuse or whether we haven't, we shouldn't have to fear that. We shouldn't be subject to that kind of humiliation. So,
but look at all the people that the stop and frisk abuse that's going on. Now it's escalated that.
Yeah, and they're doing it in the airports too. I mean, it's you know, the Chertoff X-ray porno scanners, and if you don't want to do that, then you get groped. I mean, it's and we've had a number of people who have had horrible experiences in their life that caused them not to want to get groped. I am totally with you, Grace. I want to suggest that panic attacks typically happen when we imagine a horrible future and we let it invade our present, and that you might want to just be present right now because you're totally safe right now. And you're not in that kind of a situation right now, and the odds are you never will be. And, you know, find your safety anchor right, you know, inside yourself right now, and just be there with that. And you know, when you go out in the streets, it ain't going to happen. The people who end up in jail, by and large, again, these people who protest in front of the White House, they know they're going to get arrested. The people who show up for many of these protests, they know that there's a possibility that they'll get arrested. So if you can't handle that situation, don't put yourself in it. But I would say generally, you know, be strong. Not even be strong. That sounds like a cliche. You know, find your strength and be present and don't rather than, you know, projecting that scary future. If I may be so presumptuous as to offer some advice. Is that okay, Grace?
Not really.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. Thank you very much for calling, though, and sharing your story with us.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know what else to say. I agree. This is a horrible thing, and it shouldn't have happened. And this Supreme Court, you think that's bad? Imagine, you know, the guy who the Supreme Court said, oh, you've got DNA evidence that will exonerate you, and they're going to put you to death next week? Well, that doesn't matter. Doesn't count. I mean, you know, the stakes are really high for some people. So, Mike in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. The previous caller touched upon what I wanted to talk about, so I'd just like to make a comment. I think it's very unfortunate that we, again, lost my favorite commentator, not to offend you, that is Keith Olbermann.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that was about?
Well, I don't, and I don't know Keith personally, and I don't know the players involved, and I don't think it's appropriate for me to be commenting on other people's, media programs, so I'm not going to go there. Alan in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Alan, we got a minute to the break. What's up?
Okay, Tom. Glenn Greenwald wrote yesterday in Salon.com, or Slate. No, Salon.com. about the Obama administration's Justice Department advocated for that law to be passed by the Supreme Court.
Strip search law.
Strip search law, yeah.
Yeah. And you know, as I said, there's a piece of that that makes sense. Jails should be able to protect themselves. You don't want to knock that down altogether. You don't want to be able to, you know, you don't want to say, no, jails can't make sure that a guy who, you know, has been convicted three times of assault or murder or whatever is not going to be checked out very, very carefully before we put him in with the general population. You don't want to take away that. But, again, I think that the Supreme Court should not be making these kinds of decisions. I think that these kinds of decisions should be made by legislatures. And you know, it's just that simple. So,
well, even the federal court doesn't strip search on minor offenses like white collar crime and stuff. They don't strip search them.
They may now. I mean, if you're going to jail overnight, there you go. And you know, under the new law, and it's up to the jailers. It's not up to you. It's not up to the prosecutors. It's not up to the defense attorneys. And frankly, I think that that's wrong. We'll be back. Who should be drug tested in America? CEOs or people on food stamps?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, so we've got these welfare queens out there. Bill Gates, who has made billions and billions of dollars by government regulation called the copyright law that has given special privilege to his company and made him rich. Mitt Romney, making tens of millions of dollars a year and paying almost no taxes on it because he was able to kind of game the system and get his taxes lowered. You got the CEO of GE, Jeff Immelt, who, you know, GE pays no taxes on billions of dollars in profits. You got the CEO of ExxonMobil, $400 billion in profits. No income tax. We got a lot of welfare queens out there. Let's drug test them all. Jamie Weinstein on the line with the Daily Caller, dailycaller.com. He's a senior editor at the Daily Caller. Jamie, you're in favor of drug testing all these welfare queens, right?
Well, Tom, of course, I don't consider copyright laws to be equivalent of getting government welfare. But obviously,
how are they different?
How are they different? Well, it's part of private property. The way that you create invention in society is provide copyright laws to people, so they have an incentive.
But after the second or third year of the copyright being protected, how is it any different? How is it not welfare?
It depends on how many. I mean, it takes a long time sometimes for people why is 3 years the magic number?
It's the number that Thomas Jefferson proposed. It's the number that was most often debated during the constitutional conventions. You know this history.
Yeah, but the 3 years was not set in stone.
No.
And I think that.
But Disney got it jacked up to 70.
Government, and we can determine that. But yeah, let's not get sidetracked.
Let's not get sidetracked. You want to drug test people who are on government assistance of some kind.
It's not necessarily that I'm driving to drug test them. I think it's a fair thing for people in the states to choose to do, so long as it is cost effective to do so. Some states have found that implementing the policy doesn't seem particularly cost effective. But on the principle of it, the fact that if you are accepting government largesse, money that comes from you and me and the taxpayers for government assistance, you probably should not give that to those who are on drugs because their money for poor means.
Right. So you think that the guys who are like Eric Prince, for example, the guys, the government who are getting these no-bid government contractors from their buddies like the Bush administration, that they should be drug tested? They're making billions off government
welfare. Eric Prince, but if the question is that should a corporate welfare end, where you have people who get subsidies and protections for growing sugar in the United States that protect them from trade elsewhere, the answer is yes. I think corporate welfare should end. Should we drug test them? No, we should just end it.
But you know, they're getting all this government largesse. I mean, the government is giving mind-boggling amounts of money to these millionaires and billionaires. You've seen their, you know, these 35 bedroom mansions that surround the city where you and I live. Shouldn't we be drug testing these guys?
We can debate what.
Or you just want to drug test poor people?
No, wait, Tom, I'm going to agree with you largely here. I'm actually going to go a step further. We can debate what is getting government large less in welfare and what is not. I agree that there are some very wealthy people that are getting corporate welfare in a way through crony capitalism. And I don't want the drug test them. I want to end the lifeline. I want to end the crony capitalism.
Do you want to end the lifeline to 8-year-olds on food stamps?
Well, Tom, I mean, I think this argument goes along the lines of, if you arrested a family, a father, a mother, for doing something criminal, does that affect their family as well? I think yes, but would you suggest you don't arrest them?
Well, one of the things that I know is that that we all know now is the result of Rick Scott, who owns a chain of medical clinics that drug testing, is that when he implemented drug testing for food stamp recipients in the state of Florida, that about 2% of them tested positive, and that when they randomly tested the general population down there, it was around 8%. So this seems to me punitive.
I'm actually loosely for legalizing drugs, so I mean, I don't do drugs myself, but I think on a philosophical and moral basis, it's the right policy. I still would think that drug testing of people that get government largesse would be the right thing to do.
But in other words, you're in favor of punishment even when it violates your own moral principles.
You didn't answer my question though. When I asked you, you were trying to use kind of the image of why do I want to punish 8-year-old children
right.
for drug testing?
Well,
I said,
why do you want to do that?
If their parents did something illegal, committed fraud or something, we're going to go to jail. Would you just not send them to jail? I mean, because
no, of course not.
As well,
if somebody's committed a crime, I would send them to jail. But to the best of my knowledge, applying for food stamps is not a crime.
No, but the point is that certain policies all affect families, and the people who are responsible for that is the parents themselves.
So you're saying if somebody gets laid off from their job,
I don't know what remedies.
If somebody gets laid off from their job because Republican policies blowing, you know, the Reaganomics uh-huh. blowing up our trade policy,
yep.
or for that matter, Clintonomics, if you want to make it bipartisan, blowing, you know, joining the GATT and the WTO, the factory went to Asia or to Mexico or something, they're out of work. They should be punished by being drug tested?
I think that they shouldn't be on drugs. I mean, if the question is if someone should be punished. If you're saying that anyone
why not?
Merely drug
if they're not working, if they're not driving a truck, I mean, I can understand drug testing airline pilots.
Drug testing them as punishment?
I can understand drug testing airline pilots because I don't want to get on an airplane where the pilot's been, you know, stoned in the last 24 hours. But I don't understand drug testing some guy who's sitting in his home watching TV because he can't get a job. I mean, I think he should have the right to get high, and until he can find a job, I want to make sure that he's not, you know, sick and broke and out, you know, living in my front door.
I like to be clear with principles here. So what you're suggesting is that not only do you think that there should be no drug testing, but you have no problem if the person who is receiving government aid is getting high and being subsidized by the government?
I have no problem with anybody getting high unless they're operating heavy equipment that can damage me.
Well, I do. I think that
I thought you were in favor of legalizing drugs.
I am, but I do have a problem when you give money out of the public purse to people that are getting high.
Okay, well, let's take it to the next step. Should we drug test them for alcohol?
Well, that'd be an interesting question. Let's get to legalizing drugs first.
Well, no, I mean, it's not an interesting question. I mean, if you look at this, you look at the good science that's done, and I know you're familiar with this as well. People who are equally intoxicated on marijuana versus alcohol are much more dangerous driving when they're intoxicated with alcohol than with marijuana. They're much more likely to kill or be killed. And, you know, so let's drug test everybody for alcohol.
I think that's in the state's prerogative. If they wanted to do that, I certainly wouldn't oppose it.
Okay. How about tobacco?
It's their prerogative. The states have the power to implement laws who they give money to. There's a lot of problems with you know, state finances right now, and if they think it's economically reasons to do so, and because they think that
right.
that people that are getting money from states should not be
no, I got your logic. If we the people are giving people money, then we should have the right to drug test them. So, which brings me back to my original question. Okay, we the people are giving Mitt Romney an enormous amount of money by subsidizing this, you know, this whole court system and everything else that has allowed him to get wealthy. Should he be drug tested? You know, we're subsidizing Bill Gates with the copyright laws. We're subsidizing ExxonMobil with billions of dollars in the military supplying their shipping lanes.
again, I think there's corporate welfare out there. I don't think Mitt Romney was a recipient of it by any means. The idea that he is a recipient of corporate welfare.
You think he's a self-made man? He was born a millionaire.
Oh, I think he is. He worked his way up in that position.
Oh, come on.
He absolutely did. The evidence is there. Show me how he didn't.
He used the law. He used the education that he got by virtue of being born a millionaire. He used the old boy network that he had by virtue of being born a millionaire.
Have you read the accounts of those who went to school with him and who have worked with him, how he worked harder and longer than most everyone else, was not interested?
Oh, I'm sure he worked very hard, but how hard does somebody have to work to get $20 million a year for doing nothing?
The idea that he was not a man who worked hard and was just given it silver spoon.
You know, I don't begrudge him his first $1 million a year, Jamie. Not at all.
You don't think what?
I don't begrudge him his first $1 million a year. But, you know, I think at a certain point, you can't make an argument. Well, that's a whole other argument. Jamie, we'll have to live to argue it another day, Jamie. DailyCaller.com. Jamie Weinstein. You can read his writings over there. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Which raises an interesting question. How much is too much in compensation? We know, you know, conservatives think that how much is too little, the minimum wage? How much should be the maximum wage?
And I said, no, 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 I don't smoke it no more. I'm tired of waking up on the floor. No, thank you, please, it only makes me sneeze. Then it makes it hard to find the door.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Here's a statistic I'll bet you didn't hear on Fox News. In 5 states, more than 10% of the electricity is produced by wind power now. We're going green. You know, Fox News wants to behave like, well, there's still a debate about it. No. Margie in Rawlings, Wyoming. Hey, Margie, what's up?
I wanted to call and let you and your listeners be aware of something that's going on. And it happened again yesterday in Dallas, Texas.
Okay.
When these tornadoes go through, truck drivers who are doing business at customers are being denied access to emergency shelters. We are being locked outside of buildings and left out there to die.
Truck drivers are very, very vulnerable in a tornado.
Did you see the videos yesterday?
No, I didn't. Who's locking them out?
The customers. Like, say if you're at a warehouse, like Georgia Pacific Warehouse.
Right.
Owned
by the Koch brothers.
Our trucks are locked to a dock, so we can't leave.
Right.
And we are locked outside of the building.
Oh, my. Are you a truck driver?
Yes, I am. And yesterday, one of those tornadoes hit the Schneider facility.
Mm-hmm.
And the video shows trucks being thrown hundreds of feet in the air.
Oh, sure, sure.
That's where we're stuck seeking shelter, because these corporations will not even treat us like human beings.
Well, and this is where there ought to be a law. There should be a law that, you know, like the Good Samaritan laws that says, well, not even like the Good Samaritan laws, like the law that Reagan signed in 1986, the Cobra Law, that said that a hospital, if somebody shows up in a hospital's emergency room, whether they have money or not, whether they have insurance or not, they have to be treated. And similarly, there should be a law that says that if there is, you know, radical imminent danger, like in a tornado or a flood or something, you know, whatever it may be, a natural disaster, if somebody shows up, you know, then it's not unreasonable. They're not showing up with a shotgun in your face. They're just showing up that you have to take them in. I'm with you, Margie. Thank you very much for the call. And thanks for illuminating us about this issue. Lewis in Belfast, Maine. Hey, Lewis, what's up?
Hi, Tom. The other day on your show, I heard you talking about the three Supreme Court justices attending the Federal Society fundraiser against Obamacare. Is this actionable? And if it is, how can I get the ball rolling? What agency do I contact to start seeing that people find out about it and we can take some legal action against
them? The story was reported over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. It was also reported at Republic Report, which I think is .com. There were several places where that story was reported. It's fairly easy to find. Somebody sent me an email saying, I was telling my brother about this, and he said, the Federalist Society doesn't raise money, and so this guy must have been lying, this Hartman guy. So I went to the Federalist Society's website and found their fundraising page, all the different ways that you can donate money to the Federalist Society, and email it to him. The remedy for this is exactly the remedy that President Thomas Jefferson in 1804 used against Supreme Court Justice Samuel Chase, impeachment. impeachment in the House of Representatives. And he successfully impeached Chase in the House of Representatives. Then it's followed by a trial in the Senate to be removed from office. Chase was not found guilty in the Senate, or they didn't remove him from office. But that's the process. And so if you want these Supreme Court justices to be held to account, you need to contact your member of Congress. We all have one. And even here in the District of Columbia, she can't vote, but we've got one. John in Chicago, listening on Chicago's Progressive Talk. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, you know what? I just wanted to make a comment about so-called legislation from the bench.
Mm-hmm.
I recall the Republicans screaming about legislating from the bench, courts, and judges legislating from the bench. And here we have the Republican court, Supreme Court, threatening, I guess, to repeal, or may have made a decision to repeal Obamacare, and also upholding this strip search law.
Yeah.
I just think it's kind of a slippery slope to a fascist Germany kind of state.
Well, yeah, let's not go to fascist Germany, because a lot of people's eyes start crossing when you talk about that. But the reality is that in 1954, after Brown versus Board of Education, Fred Koch, Daddy Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, who made his fortune doing oil deals with Joseph Stalin in the Soviet Union, Freddie Koch took a good chunk of that fortune and helped fund the John Birch Society, helped create it, and was putting posters, billboards all over this country that said impeach Earl Warren. I remember as a little kid seeing those things on highways, you know, across Michigan, mm-hmm. across the western states. And then after Roe v. Wade in 73, they got even more hysterical about impeach the, you know, Earl Warren and the Supreme Court and all this kind of thing. You know, the judicial activism, the judges making laws, is wrong. It's just wrong. It's just totally wrong. And, you know, and I would submit that as good as Brown versus Board of Education was, it would have been passed into law soon anyway. And, in fact, it was 11 years later in 1965, Lyndon Johnson. So, anyhow, Brad in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Brad, got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, you know, it's amazing to me to hear the things you say, like you just mentioned, judges don't make laws, but how come every time there's something voted for by the people, then it gets sued over, there's a court case, and then all of a sudden the judges are now making laws? So for you to say that...
Because in 1803, Chief Justice John Marshall, in a case called Marbury versus Madison, decided on his own that the Supreme Court could strike down laws. It's not in the Constitution.
But if you're going to use that statement generally, it happens all the time.
I know.
Think back to the reason of my original call is even in your supposed news, which they say is more opinion than news, because you kind of back it up with these are the bad guys and so on. You talk about
it is opinion. I'll tell you right up front.
But you say your last thing said this is the news.
I'm no, like, I said on the news. It's my opinion on the news.
I mean, it's
but that like, that you know, notwithstanding, I don't get your argument about judicial review.
Okay, but you said that we had we have this issue with the government taking over and this and that. But Obama is the president during this time.
So you want to yell about Obama? Okay, Brad, thanks a lot for the call. I thought there was something of substance there. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can hang out with some of the finest minds on earth for free over at TomHartman.com in our live chat room. I'm going to go say hi there right now. I want a new drug. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you, as in small d. Mitt Romney, by the way, as a great photo over at DU today. Romney seeking VP who can bring ideological balance to the ticket. He might have found somebody. Clip number four, Jacob.
It does appear to me, and I think to most people, that the world's getting warmer. And it also appears to me that we're contributing to that. But I know that it's a good idea, this kind of setting, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. I'd also like to get us off of foreign oil, and those two things are linked for me.
Right. We got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We got to get off foreign oil. Invest in green energy. Clip number five. This is Mitt Romney's new running mate, the guy who disagrees with the current Mitt Romney.
I'd like to see us using our renewable resources, solar, wind. I'd like more cellulosic ethanol, biodiesel, biofuel, blue green algae-oriented biodiesel, all these sources. And the list goes on and on. And I would invest substantially more dollars in developing basic science that could help develop some of these technologies.
Oh, yeah. Let's have some basic science. Let's invest some dollars in blue-green algae. Yeah. And meanwhile, we have global warming. Now that the new MIT doesn't agree with the old MIT, that is, Jim has some video of this. So for those of you who are watching us on Dish Network or DirecTV, the cable systems around the country on Free Speech TV, this is a tractor trailer spinning around on the ground in Dallas-Fort Worth as a result of that tornado. That's the video that the caller must have been, the caller from who was listening on Sirius Satellite Radio was referencing. So pretty amazing stuff, pretty scary stuff. Anyhow, back to the news of the day and our topics. Stanley in West Point, Mississippi. Hey, Stanley, what's up?
Oh, how are you this afternoon, Tom? I really appreciate your program. And I just think it's extremely vindictive of people to want to drug test welfare and food stamp recipients. I mean, why pick on the poor people?
Because they're poor.
Exactly. Congressmen and senators are paid with tax dollars as well.
Right.
So if they're going to do that, I think that they need to be drug tested once a month as well as randomly. You know, what's good for one is good for all in a democracy.
Yeah. And so maybe we should start, drug testing them.
If you apply for your driver's license, you should be drug tested. And whenever you apply, go to vote, let's drug test. I mean, let's just drug test all of society. And officers of the court, which would be your lawyers and judges, should be drug tested as well if we're going to go down this road.
Yeah, it's crazy talk, and it's another example of the. I mean, this is one of those places where big government, to use a conservative phrase, is out of control. The war on drugs is big government out of control. Drug testing is big government out of control. And these are things, these are big government programs that conservatives absolutely love and that should be done away with.
I don't understand the mindset of America today that we want to be so vindictive against the poor, yet we can give billions of dollars in foreign aid to countries to come buy guns and weapon systems from our military-industrial complex.
Well, there's money to be made, Stanley. It's really simple. There's money to be made, and as I've said many times in this program, we have a two-tier justice system in the United States. We have a two-tier pretty much everything system in the United States. There's one set of rules for the very, very rich, and there's one set of rules for all the rest of us. And arguably, there's a third set of rules for the really, really poor, and that's the whole idea of let's drug test them, let's humiliate them, let's strip search them, et cetera, et cetera. Dave in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm just calling. I was wondering, listening to this drug conversation that this Weinstein was having with you, what about, like, what happened at the Interior Department under Bush? When there was all those people in there doing drugs with the oil companies and the gas company and the coal company.
They were starting coke, weren't they?
The coke, meth, it was all kinds of stuff. Whatever happened to all that?
Yeah, and they had, and I think there were some hookers involved in that one, too.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to be testing people for multiple sexual partners, although I'm not sure how you do that.
We need to put this in their faces. Who really needs drug tested in this country?
Well, in my opinion, nobody. And
I agree with you.
And unless somebody is exhibiting behavior that causes you to think that they are under the influence of drugs, then, give them the breathalyzer, or in the case of some other drug, check them out. But, if it's not the guy flying my airplane or the guy who's driving the truck that's coming down the highway, in the opposite direction from me, I frankly don't care. And I don't care if they're on unemployment or if it's Mitt Romney making $20 million a year sitting around the pool on his butt. I don't care if they're taking drugs. And I think it's none of the rest of our business. Dave, thank you for the call. And it's time for us to get rid of this big government mentality that the Republicans have been promoting ever since Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs. These big government Republicans are making me crazy. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, John.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just wanted to point out a thing about my experience with the drug testing and stuff. I do construction work. I'm a retired iron worker.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was when I got hurt. And when I got hurt, workman's comp sent me to their doctor, which was a sports doctor, And she said, toughen up, and pumped me full of narcos and somas. Sent me right back out in the field to do work with heavy equipment and stuff like that. And that was more dangerous than anything else. And when I went to a regular specialist, a doctor with my back, he immediately took me off the workforce and gave me an MRI and so had a split tailbone. And they had to go and immediately pick me in for an operation. So this drug testing thing is just another arm and control factor of the insurance companies having a big handle on our government.
Hmm. And in other words, they didn't want to pay for your treatment, and they wanted to keep you on the and they didn't want to pay for you for workman's comp.
No, they want to put me back out there and have me kill myself.
Right. That's sad. John, thank you for sharing the story. I mean, you know, we don't want our steel workers working while high, just like we don't want talk show hosts working while high. You know, we've seen the results of both. No, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to pick on poor Rush. But it's not a good outcome. And but that doesn't mean that you drug test people. It means when they start behaving weird, you go, I wonder what's going on here. And if it's going to put people's lives at risk, you do something about it. Matt in Bakersfield, California. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, wow, I can't believe I made it. Not a lot here in Bakersfield, Atlanta. I'm kind of beating a dead horse here, but I was calling about the drug testing people on unemployment or welfare. And, you know, the guy, on one hand, he's kind of a libertarian, doesn't believe in outlawing drugs. And on the other hand, he wants to check people if they're getting government assistance. And it's like, where do you draw the line? Alcohol, fried foods, smoking cigarettes, you know, are your children obese? Are you renting movies? Are you getting cable TV? Are you know,
have you walked 3 miles today? Yeah,
exactly.
You know, it is punitive. I mean, let's just be honest about this. The idea of drug testing poor people, unemployed people, the powerless and the economically disadvantaged in society, that idea is a way of making them uncomfortable. It's punitive. And the thought process behind that is that, and it's flawed, is that most people who are on unemployment or on food stamps want to be, choose to be, and are doing so because of some kind of moral failing. And if we can just kick their butts hard enough, they'll get up off their butts and they'll go out there and get a job. And the fact of the matter is, the jobs aren't there. The fact of the matter is that when we had a booming economy and 4% unemployment in our maximum 5% unemployment in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, when things were doing really, really well in the United States, we weren't having these conversations. It wasn't that, you know, it's not that there's a certain there is a small percentage, 1 or 2% of the population who are mentally ill, and they're going to, you know, no matter what, they're going to sit around and get high, and, you know, we just need to live with that as a society. But it's not that you know, we've got a 9% unemployment right now, therefore 9% of the people want to sit around on their butts all day. It's the people want a job. You know, and punishing them because they can't find a job, or punishing them because they make so little at their job as a Walmart greeter that they have to have food stamps in order to be able to eat, or they need government assistance, they need Medicare in order or Medicaid in order for their kids to get health insurance, is insane. It's punitive. It's not just insane. It's punitive. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Matt. Mark Taylor Canfield from Seattle. Hey, Mark, you got an update on the Occupy movement?
Yeah, Tom, I have a really quick news report out of Seattle here. There's a huge challenge to our freedom of speech and assembly. And tomorrow at 3 p.m., there's a public hearing, and that is before the Community College School District Board of Trustees. The reason that people need to be there is because they're passing new rules, which are basically anti-Occupy movement rules. It's a response to the fact that Occupy Seattle had an encampment there last fall. And before this new set of rules, actually, Tom, there were no state laws regulating camping on campuses, state college campuses, so no one was breaking the law. But the college went to court, got the camp evicted, and now they're passing new laws, new rules for all the community college campuses in Seattle, which include signs can't be larger than 3 feet by 5 feet. No one is allowed to hold more than one sign at a time. There are so-called free speech zones, or the only places that people can protest. Non-campus groups will have to notify the campus 24 hours in advance to any demonstrations, and anyone who violates these rules are subject to arrest for trespass.
Yeah.
So I really encourage people in Seattle to be there at Seattle Central Community College tomorrow at 3 p.m. for this public hearing.
There you go.
Definitely stand up for
it. It sounds like they're going down the same road that the Tampa's going down. They're hosting the RNC, and they just made it illegal to wear a Guy Fawkes mask. Thanks,
You're
Mark.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's pretty incredible, you know, when you think about it. In Tampa, where the RNC is going to hold their convention, it's legal to walk around with a gun. It's not legal to walk around with more than 6 inches of string.
Boy, accuse me. Take a look at yourself.
One last time.
Boy, accuse me.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And now, Talk Radio News brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, giving sacks of hope to people who... having a pretty damn hard time in southern Sudan.
It's a good Easter thing, Passover thing to do. Slaves,
yeah.
Passover, you know,
oh, yeah.
Easter.
Because the CSI, Christian
Solidarity
International.
Not a Bible-thumping group.
Yeah, they are basically rescuing slaves.
Right.
And, you know, and
you were there.
I was there, yes. I was there with you. In fact, you helped me get there. Thank you very much for that. So what's going on in the
world?
Okay,
well, I guess the big news is that Santorum is apparently leading so far in Pennsylvania. Word on the street in Washington was he's going to drop out of the race if he didn't think he could win Pennsylvania. He has a lead, some are describing it, a shaky lead, a few points, but 5-6 points currently,
but
depending.
It's still 3 weeks out, which means that
Romney can put all his tons of money there.
Right. The Romney money bomb of negative ads and tear him down has not yet hit Pennsylvania.
And don't forget, it's not just Romney's money.
All that Wall Street money.
Yeah.
73% of all the Wall Street money has gone just to Mitt Romney, 91% to Republican candidates.
Because he's a Bain guy.
That's right. He's a bankster.
That's right.
He's a bankster.
A bainster.
Yes, a bainster.
Okay. He also today did talk at the newspaper editors, just like the president spoke yesterday. He called it a hide-and-seek campaign. He said the president disguises his real intentions. Of course, that's to say, you know, he's really a lefty, folks.
He's a secret Muslim.
Right.
His real intention is to turn us into Sharia law.
In terms of the Russian situation, he's saying what the public doesn't know won't hurt them. That's his view.
In other words, he thinks that's Obama's view.
That's right. Exactly. And he said that the Mike incident where he said, you know, let's wait until after the election.
Right.
He said, what exactly does the President Obama intend to do differently once he's no longer accountable to the voters? And he said, by flexibility, which the president said, of course, give me some flexibility. He said, what the American public knows won't hurt him. And that was his thing on that. He charged the president had failed to enact or even propose a serious, plan to solve the entitlement crisis. Again, he said that the president was hiding his true purpose.
Wait a minute. The entitlement crisis. The president's proposed that we lift the cap on Social Security, which would make it solvent forever. And the president pushed through the Affordable Care Act, which largely solved the problems with Medicare and Medicaid. What's Romney talking about?
His bainsters.
I asked the question on the air yesterday, Ellen, seriously. I asked the serious question. Now that the Paul Ryan budget is out and Romney has endorsed it and people know, you know, over a 30-year period, it's going to take out 95% of the discretionary government except for the military. I mean, it's going to eliminate the EPA, Department of Education, CDC, everything. How can Republicans possibly run for president or any other position having endorsed this unless they lie? I don't get it. You know,
that's what they're basically accusing the president of doing.
Right. Yeah, I shouldn't ask you. You're an actual reporter.
He said that Obama was hiding his true purpose, and then he said to the newspaper editors, you and I are going to have to do the seeking. I just want to go through three quickies. I know we don't have a lot of time. But the 9/11 conspirators at Gitmo, I guess there are four others, including five, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. They will be tried at Guantanamo within the next coming month, and the suspects are eligible for the death penalty if found guilty. Also, Sheriff Apayo today, remember him of Arizona, he has refused a court-appointed monitor over the claim that he was discriminated against Latinos, and so now the Justice Department is going to file a lawsuit against him. And also New Orleans, four former police officers from Katrina, as you know, they were convicted in August, I believe. One got 65 years, one 40, one 38 years, another guy 6 years. And
they were convicted of shooting fleeing African-Americans from New Orleans who were trying to make it across a bridge, as I recall,
that's
to
exactly
safety.
Right.
And they were shooting and killing people.
Susan Bartholomew, she got a loss of her right arm. Leonard lost his 44 years old, shot in the leg. Another one shot in both legs and in the stomach. One was shot in the face. And then a James Brissette was shot in the back, and he died on the bridge. And then apparently they also just sort of hit and just stomped on these people.
Right. Now, this is a story that has gotten virtually no coverage at all. If this had been a group of black police officers who were convicted of shooting at
a white family,
it would be wall-to-wall on Fox News. And all. I mean, the double standard in America is shocking. It just is genuinely shocking.
Yeah, it's not pretty. Also, by the way, there was an attack on a theater in Mogadishu in Somalia, a female suicide bomber today. Okay. And this was the first anniversary of their television, the anniversary of their television going on. The president had a prayer breakfast this morning, he invoked a lot of God, a lot of Christ, all of that. But I think what's so interesting, he said that Christ had his own doubts. He told us as much in the book of John when he said, in this world you will have trouble. Let me repeat, in this world you will have trouble. So he was really talking about that. This was, as opposed to the big prayer breakfast, which is a big political thing, this was 100 people from across the country invited to the White House. Very different kind of prayer breakfast.
Interesting.
And Jay Carney today defended the president. He said, the president made an unremarkable observation about 80 years of Supreme Court history. This is because the Fifth District Court yesterday said that the president, they demanded to know what the president's true view of the Supreme Court. They wanted a one-page, single-spaced, or whatever.
Three pages.
Yeah,
demanded.
But
at least
single-spaced.
Single-spaced, yes. And we want it now. His position on judicial review. How dare he? You know, Jefferson actually successfully impeached, didn't remove from office. The Senate wimped out, but he successfully impeached Samuel Chase in 1804 around this issue. Anyhow, Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service. GoatsForTheOldGoat.com.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Today is the 44th. Anniversary. Today, April 4th, is the 44th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And the question still hangs in the air. Who killed him and why? Stuart Wexler is with us. He's an investigative researcher, co-author with Larry Hancock of a book titled The Awful Grace of God: Religious Terrorism, White Supremacy, and the Unsolved Murder of Martin Luther King Jr. And, Stuart, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Unsolved murder? According to the government, this is solved, is it not?
Well, actually, according to the Congress, who reinvestigated the case in the late 1970s under what we call the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the case is unsolved. They argued that Ray, James Earl Ray, the man who was arrested, confessed, and convicted of having shot Martin Luther King, only to recant. They believe that he was part of a larger conspiracy, and that's what they reported to the American public in 1978. So the FBI initially indicated it was James Earl Ray alone in 1968, but when Congress reopened the case, they actually concluded it was a wider conspiracy.
So who were the conspirators?
Well, we target a slightly different group than they did, although in the same sort of spirit as they did. We believe that the main culprits were likely, we were not conclusive about it, but the likely candidates were a network of radical white supremacists who really should probably be thought of more as religious terrorists than, you know, redneck racists. Mm-hmm. And they had been trying to kill King for a decade. We believe that they had reached out to criminal elements, a group of outlaws known as the Dixie Mafia, with large money bounty offers. Those bounty offers were circulating in prisons across the country, where someone like James Earl Ray, who escaped from prison in April of 1967, would have been aware of them, and had he pursued it further after his escape, when he became more and more desperate for money, could have become entwined in such a plot.
The thing that always gave me pause was, you know, the theory that was put forward by the Justice Department, by the FBI after the assassination of Dr. King, was that James Earl Ray was this kind of lone wolf kook who stalked and ultimately killed Dr. King. And yet, after the assassination, this guy didn't, like, just go hide in the woods, like the guy who murdered the abortion doctor who hid in the woods in South Carolina for a year or so. He had a rather extensive travelogue. You want to tell us the details?
Well, Ray, after the assassination occurred in Memphis on April 4th, 1968, Ray first goes back to where he had been, Atlanta, and then he travels on through Canada, out from Canada into Europe, where he was in Portugal, and then eventually he was captured in England and brought back to the United States, extradited here.
Right.
Now, that is true. He didn't make this extensive sort of escape, but actually, if you look into it, the FBI went and talked to prisoners within Jefferson City Prison, where Ray had been before he escaped, and they said that was something that would have been well known, that escaping via Canada, which was Ray was actually trying to do after he immediately left Jefferson City in April of 1967, was well known to people who were in prison. And Ray himself had looked into a couple of countries, notably Rhodesia, which had no extradition treaty with the United States.
So this is kind of the equivalent of back in the old Westerns, you know, the old John Wayne movies, I got to get to Mexico.
Right.
Yeah. Beyond the reach of the law.
That, yes. That,
yeah.
Going from Canada out of the United States was something that wasn't unknown to criminals.
Right. But it also wasn't cheap.
Well, James Earl Ray, actually, and the people always say, where did he get the money to do A, B, and C?
Right.
Now, there is a little bit of sort of mystery around that, and you can't pinpoint it 100%, and it may well be, again, we argue there was a conspiracy that he had some kind of nest egg connected with that. But the more likely scenario is, I mean, he was robbing banks in Europe. That's what one of the things he did. He got he robbed a bank there. He himself talked about robbing grocery stores to sort of get by. So if you actually look at his actions, it doesn't speak of somebody who, you know, came into this, you know, huge, you know, well-supported
payoff for doing it.
Payoff.
Which
we think he was trying to get to that payoff. We just don't believe he ultimately got to it yet.
Okay. So, what is the post story of the conspirators who put him up to this thing?
And, well, you know, it's interesting. James Earl Ray,
where are they now?
James Earl Ray took on some attorneys after he was arrested and tried and convicted. And again, Ray would then denounce his conviction, which we can get into. One of the attorneys was a guy named J.B. Stoner. Now, J.B. Stoner was one of the most vile white supremacists around for a couple of decades. He also was an attorney. He was one of the leaders of the National States Rights Party, which was, on the surface, a political organization, but had been involved in quite a bit of violence, so extreme, in fact, that many of the Klans even avoided them. Stoner, he took on as one of his attorneys. Now, our argument is, if you follow the book, that Stoner had been connected with a couple of plots against King up until that point. He was hooked into this white supremacist network that wanted a race war. And so Ray's choice to have him as an attorney is suspicious. Now, you know, someone could argue with some reason Stoner was well known for running around and defending racists. But if you're James Earl Ray, even the appearance that you're a racist would undermine your legal case.
Sure.
What's even more interesting is when Congress went to reinvestigate the case in the late 1970s, Ray, who had a number of attorneys represent him over time trying to get him out of prison because he claimed he was, you know, tricked into confessing, there was one attorney that James Earl Ray would not waive attorney-client privilege for, and that was J.B. Stoner.
Interesting. So, they may have been co-conspirators, is what
well,
you're suggesting.
Well, what we hint at, and again, there's some limits to what we can say, but
sure.
The impression that we have is that Ray, that nothing went according to plan in Memphis.
Right.
Ray was attempting to try and get a major bounty, and that what ultimately happened was he had to play a game, and
right.
The game was, I'm going to claim I'm completely innocent so I can get out of jail. And blame a mysterious figure known as Raoul.
Right, right. I remember.
Stuart,
we just have 30 seconds left. To what extent is there still a white racist network that might promote this kind of behavior in the United States?
Oh, they're still very much very active. They're actually a huge influence over groups like the Aryan Nations, and you know they're still very much a threat.
And these are the groups that are called out by like the Southern Poverty Law Center and whatnot.
Oh yes, they're heavily influenced. They're basically the church for the Aryan Nations, this sort of religious sect.
That's very interesting. So in your opinion, the people who were actually behind the killing of King were never actually brought to justice.
No, and much could be done to bring them to justice if with a few simple steps, and that's sort of the goal of our book.
And are any of them still alive?
Well, none of the ones that we talk about in depth are alive, but
yeah.
That does not mean that people associated with them, who we maybe haven't dug into yet,
right.
Are not alive and could be prosecuted.
Stuart Wexler, the book is The Awful Grace of God, theawfulgraceofgod.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you, Stuart, very much for being with us. Appreciate it. A tragic loss 44 years ago today. We'll be back.
I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up, live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal.
There you go. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A terrible loss 44 years ago today. Pierre in Romana, California. Hey, Pierre, what's up? Pierre? Hello? Okay. Owen in Tampa, Florida. Hey, Owen, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Great. How you doing?
Pretty good. Longtime fan, man. I'm a graduate student of anthropology at USF and a full-time occupier as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of wanted to give you the lowdown because I heard you mention Tampa today.
Yeah.
And so,
the RNC is coming to town, and they've outlawed Guy Fawkes masks and string more than 6 inches. I don't get the string part. I can see where they don't want people wearing masks because they want to be able to identify them so they can arrest them and strip search them. But they've outlawed pieces of plastic pipe. I suppose that could be used as a weapon. But 6 inches of string?
Yeah, they're kind of out of control. They also have an armored personnel, a corporate-sponsored armored personnel carrier with an LRAD gun and a water cannon on top to drive by us just to kind of keep us on our toes. And pretty much since we've left the downtown park and actually are on a private park where we were given permission to be in Main Street. So we really went from Wall Street to Main Street. And we've been focusing on, like, positive direct actions like community gardening and worker appreciation and these types of things. We really haven't gotten any local news. But today or yesterday when he did the state of the city speech or whatever he did, it was mostly because of us, because we have like 27 court cases from December 1st in the process right now, and we're really a thorn in their side, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's the, you know, what was it, Teddy Roosevelt, who said, you know, dissent is the most patriotic thing you can do, or some variation thereof. That's the
Absolutely.
Essence of American patriotism, is dissent. Well, good on you, Owen, and thanks for the update on what's going on with Occupy Tampa. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks for everything you do. Long-time fan, man.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Josh in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Josh, you are in favor of drug testing.
Yes, I am, actually.
Drug testing who?
Drug testing welfare recipients or pretty much anybody on government assistance.
Why?
Well, first let me say that I'm actually for the legalization of drug. I'm for the legalization of drugs.
So you're a hypocrite.
But no, I'm not a hypocrite. If somebody's receiving government assistance, that's taxpayer money going
right.
to them.
Right. And so therefore, you don't think that they should have a good time. They should sit around in misery.
No, they shouldn't sit around in misery. But
they shouldn't have a good time.
I'm sorry. Say that again. I couldn't hear you.
But they shouldn't have a good time.
No, it's not about having a good time. As I said, I'm all for the legalization of drugs. If it was a legal asset, then yeah, it would be fine.
Do you think getting high is having a good time?
Me personally, no, I've been high. I don't find it to be a good time. I'd much rather have a few drinks.
Well, I would submit to you that people who take drugs do it because it makes them feel good. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is if somebody has lost their job and are on unemployment, or if somebody's 10 years old and their parents can't afford to feed them and they're on food stamps, that you want to drug test them by way of punishing them because you don't want them to feel good.
It's not a means of punishment, Tom. It's more of a means of what comes first. Does food come first, or does my recreational activities come
first?
So
you want to follow them around and see, make sure that they're using your money appropriately. You know, the amount of money that goes to welfare recipients in the United States is a fraction of the amount of money that goes to people like Mitt Romney. Why not follow them around?
As I said, anybody receiving government assistance, not just welfare. I mean, anybody that receives subsidies or any kind of government loan.
Yeah.
I mean,
Josh, so student loans. You want to anybody who's going to college. This is this kind of punitive. I get your point. Thank you for the call. And this kind of punitive mindset, I find bizarre. I'll just leave it at that. I don't want to characterize Josh personally. I just find it bizarre. Charles in Louisiana. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hey, you know what? Actually, I wanted to comment on the last caller real quick, because I actually think he's headed somewhere in the right direction. Maybe you can articulate it as well. You know, they have the ATM cards now. I'm in California, not Louisiana, Los Angeles.
Oh,
and
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. We've got debit cards now for our unemployment. And I think this is fantastic, because if there's somebody taking government dollars, using it for something that they shouldn't be, then they should be able to take that money out of their account or shut their account down, because that's misappropriation.
So you think if somebody's on unemployment and they use their money to buy new clothes, that's fine. If they use their money to buy a big screen TV, that's fine. But if they use their money to go to a strip club, you want to take their benefits away?
I would take their away if they bought a big screen TV.
Wow. Man, you really want huge government, don't you? You want the government following everybody, keeping track of everything they do.
It's not that I want huge government. I want that control where this money is going.
Right. You want government control over the people.
No, but listen, I also think that as a taxpayer, I should be able to earmark my dollars to where they're spent and what resources they're allocated for.
Oh, yeah? Well, try telling that to the IRS. Try telling them that you don't want to pay a certain amount of your taxes because it's going to fill in the blank, you know, whatever your least favorite use is.
Words in my mouth. I didn't say I don't want to pay a certain amount of my taxes. I'm saying I should be allowed to earmark or allocate where those resources go. I'd rather see my tax dollars going into infrastructure than see my tax dollars going into health.
If you want to do that, Charles, the way you do that is by running for political office or by working within the political system to have people who share your worldview elected to office to make laws to that effect. And those laws may be drug testing. I mean, that's what they're doing down in Florida. But go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, here in California, you know, we've actually are working, and we have worked to reform our electoral process so we can actually elect people that aren't all about big money, so we can actually make that change. So we've had Prop 14, we've had that progress. We just need to have it on a national level so that when it comes down to Congress and it comes down to the president, they can actually do something for us.
Charles, we're out of time, but thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Speaking of California, San Francisco, the largest city in America that has instant runoff voting. You want to start the process of having the will of the people? Try instant IRP. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very pusillanimously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, food for your brain. The good, Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. Malloy is poised to sign into law a measure to repeal the death penalty in Connecticut for future crimes. The democratically controlled Senate will be voting on the bill later this week, and according to Senate President Pro Tem Donald Williams, there should be enough votes to pass it. Connecticut previously tried to repeal the death penalty in 2009, but the measure was vetoed by then-Governor Jody Rell. The United States is the only Western democracy to carry out the death penalty in 2011. It's time other states followed in Connecticut's footsteps and helped stop the death penalty in America. The bad. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Despite being declared unconstitutional on two separate occasions, Walker's voter ID law still managed to disenfranchise voters in yesterday's Wisconsin primary. An 87-year-old woman was prevented from voting in Waukesha, Wisconsin, when she showed up to the polls without bringing a form of ID with her. However, she'd already registered to vote months before at Waukesha City Hall. Her name was even listed on the official poll list, but she was still turned away anyway. So despite being declared unconstitutional and having been suspended, Walker's ID law is still rearing its ugly head. And the very, very ugly Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam. Haslam announced yesterday that he will likely sign into law a bill that attacks the teaching of global warming, biological evolution, and the chemical origin of life, among other scientific topics. The bill serves to intimidate school administrators from disciplining teachers who teach the most outlandish, faulty science in their classrooms. Basically, Haslam wants to allow state teachers to say whatever they want about scientific concepts, regardless of the actual facts. Haslam joins the likes of the Heartland Institute in wanting to censor the education of our children, our nation's children, just to feed the interests of corporations and conservative think tanks, and that is very, very ugly. Whew. Wow, that's very ugly. Amazing. I mean, that's very ugly. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to bring up the idea.
Hey, John, if you're on a speakerphone, can you pick it up so we can hear you?
I just wanted to bring up the idea that, you know, often there is a tyranny of the majority over, you know, certain minority groups.
Sure.
And, you know, a case in point was the Indian Removal Act of 1830, you know, which, I mean, just the name of it suggests something that was pretty horrific, and it, you know, happened to time and time again in the history of our country.
Yes.
But also, you know...
Slavery during that period of time was legal also. But right, it was slavery was supported by the Supreme Court. The Indian Removal Act was knocked down by the Supreme Court, but Andrew Jackson said, John Marshall has made his decision, let him enforce it. He refused to go along with it.
And it was not enforced, and as a result, it went back to that tribe, the Cherokee tribe.
As a result, you had the Trail of Tears, I believe.
The Trail of Tears. But anyway, but even more importantly, in our own day and age, I mean, I was amazed after 9/11 how quickly we were able to give up our civil liberties for fear, you know, security.
Yes.
And if you talk to a lot of people in the demos, the democracy in the majority, maybe, they seem to be more afraid than, really, I think, supportive of freedom. And I think you're supportive of the idea of freedom. You've mentioned that why are we so, afraid of things. It's just interesting.
I don't disagree with anything that you're saying. However, I think that the point that you're trying to make, John, is that therefore we should have nine wise elders in black robes two blocks from where I'm sitting about these things.
I really don't know what, you know, how you can protect, the rights of a minority or the rights of a party, political party, from, being really picked
on. Over the short term, you can't. Over the long term, it becomes obvious to everybody, and things change. I mean, when this country started, we had slavery.
Right.
In Massachusetts, you could be stoned for being gay, for being a witch, for being, a woman who was an herbalist or a midwife. We just had horrible laws in the United States right up until the middle part of the 19th century. Women were property of their husbands.
Right.
Supreme Court ruled that, by the way.
Jerry has been involved in protecting the rights of minorities at every level in the state
But the history of the Supreme Court is not protecting the rights of the minorities. That is the goal of the Constitution. That's the goal of a republic.
It may not have been that is how things have happened, but I'm talking about the judiciary broadly, that it often does act to protect the rights of an individual or the rights of a small group.
When it enforces the law, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you know,
that's why you have a court.
Yeah, sometimes, though, we enact laws, and, yes, we have to wait. So how long do you have to wait?
Well, in the case of slavery, we had to wait about eight generations. I mean, it was a horrible, long wait.
Maybe the Supreme Court, if they were acting properly, could have...
The Supreme Court made the situation worse. Look at Dred Scott.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you, just entirely.
No, I get your angst, John. It's a question that all of us have, and this was the big debate. I mean, it's fascinating to go back and read James Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention, because this is the stuff that these people struggled with. How do we create a republic, a nation of laws in which the minorities are protected, the rights of the minorities are protected, and they were not at that time talking about racial minorities or gender minorities, they were talking about political minorities and religious minorities. How do you make sure that the minorities, and by the way, for many of them, religious minorities included, deism and atheism, how do you protect, and Quakerism, how do you protect the rights of the minorities from the tyranny of the majority? And the conclusion that they came to is you do it with a Bill of Rights. You do it with a Constitution.
Now, that is the law.
Pardon?
Exactly. You codify it in law. Like, for instance, in the UK, I don't think they have as much freedom of speech. They can decide as a, the Parliament can decide that a certain, a book or something is seditious. Like, for instance, I think the memoirs of an MI5 agent was not permitted to be published in the UK. It was published in, I think, Australia and in the United States. So,
well, there are books that have not been allowed to be published in the United States either for, national security grounds. But you're right. The UK doesn't have a First Amendment. They don't have an absolute right of protection of free speech. But we don't anymore either, because the Supreme Court has eroded it.
If I may, interject here, it just seems, as far as I'm concerned, what I've observed with minority groups and with people who have very unpopular opinions, that if you put it on a scale of 1 to 10, as in Western societies and Western democracies, we don't really do real well. I mean, I think one of
the reasons we don't do well, John, is because we think the Supreme Court's going to take care of it. It's like when the ACLU was defending the Nazis in Skokie, Illinois. That was an example of people actually getting out and being active.
If I may say one more thing. I would like to live in a country where people really did have the right to say things, even things that, that I disagreed with, that people could go to Tampa, Florida and demonstrate. We had an RNC here in St. Paul.
I was there.
The entire, they prevented people from moving around who lived there.
I know.
They couldn't go to the usual restaurants they went to. I had patients that I couldn't send outside, and we were a mile away because the hospital was afraid that there may be, you know, problems, you know, and things like this. And it's like, you people are paranoid. It was a beautiful day or weekend, you know, that they had that. And, you know, Minnesota is cold, and this was one of the first, you know, really nice days. And we have patients whose families come, you know, from North and South Dakota. We couldn't send them outside. And I voiced my opinion about that to the administration. And I told them, look, that's terrible. You know, that people are so paranoid and so afraid. We can't have political, assemblies without having, you know, people express an opinion of the other side. And we go along with that, both the Democrats and the Republicans.
But the solution, John, and it comes back to what Jefferson said, and not just Jefferson, so many of his colleagues at the time, over and over and over again, and de Tocqueville wrote about in Democracy in America in 1836.
Yes, yes,
it comes back
to
an informed and educated populace. It comes back to citizen activism. It comes back to people getting active. And I would submit to you that as long as Americans think that our rights are being protected by the Supreme Court, and therefore we don't have to do anything, we can just sit back and watch reruns of Psych, you know, to put down Psych. I mean, that's what I did last night. It's like instead of watching Mitt Romney, hey, you know, I'd much rather watch a rerun of Psych. The point is that as long as Americans think that somebody else is going to save us, somebody else is going to protect us, we don't get involved. And
you have to be involved.
Right. And this is one of the reasons, another one of the reasons, you know, one of the more subtle kind of psychobabble reasons that I'm opposed to judicial review, because it should be we, the people, reviewing the constitutionality of laws. And if they're unconstitutional, we vote out the bums who put them in and vote in people who will change them. And we don't think that way because we think, oh, there's these nine guys in black robes who are going to take care of everything. And it's another one of the problems of judicial review. John, thank you for the call. Very thoughtful call. I really appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your thoughts and mine on the news of the day and the five preposterous, persistent conservative myths right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
You want a good case for drug testing? Jacob just gave you this. Maybe we should start drug testing Scalia. I don't know. A Tennessee judge, this is Associated Press story, a Tennessee judge was so addicted to, written by Sheila Burke, was so addicted to prescription drugs during his final 2 years on the bench that he was buying drugs from people he had just convicted of selling drugs and was having sex with people during his courtroom breaks. Amazing. He left he got a Limbaugh kind of sentence. He left the bench to seek drug treatment before pleading guilty to misconduct. Amazing. Pierre in Ramona, California, listening on XM. Hey, Pierre, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm sitting on horseback here in San Diego County.
Wow.
Occupier. Yeah.
Hey, you're occupying a horse.
Yeah. She's occupying me right now. But okay. I used to do drug testing back in '89 for in Riverside, California, for corporations and city ordinances and stuff like that. And we had a deputy choke a guy to death. He was a undocumented worker, and they, you know, some of the people in town, they wanted to have this deputy drug tested, and the police union just yelled up and down, you know, nobody's testing my deputies.
Right.
Well, you know, there's seven illicit drugs that are on a DOT test, and you know, they're all the illegal ones, you know, meth, heroin, stuff like that. And he wouldn't come out of his house for days, afraid that he was going to get tested. But he didn't know for what. And we found out later, he was on steroids. And steroids was not an illegal drug at the time. So he would have gotten off scot-free if they tested him.
Right, but they do affect your behavior wildly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, they got them so, you know, so jacked up that, you know, these guys, you can tell which ones are righted out, you know. They're all fucked up and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And we try to get the city council, that's what I was there for, to get everybody in the city. If they're going to, you know, drug test one person, they ought to do everybody. And the city council said, no.
What? Drug test us? No. Okay.
Anyway, so.
Good one. Pierre, thanks for calling and sharing the story, and enjoy the rest of your horse ride there. It's good hearing from you. Mike in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Well, you sort of moved on a little bit, but I just wanted to ask, what do you think of the judicial review of the passing of Proposition 8 out in California?
I am opposed to judicial review, whether it agrees with me or disagrees with me.
Okay, good. Well, that's good. At least you're consistent. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Okay.
You were talking about drug testing of welfare recipients.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Well, frankly, I think that's a solution in search of a problem, because statistically it's probably not going to save you enough money to warrant the expense.
No, it's not. In fact, when they started doing it in Florida, what they discovered was that 8% of the general population tested positive and 2% of the welfare population did. So you're absolutely right, Mike. Thanks for the call. Lenny in New York City, listening to WWRL. Hey, Lenny, what's up?
Oh, not too much, Tom. Listen, just a couple of things real quick. Very early in my career, I worked in prison health. And right after that, I worked in a methadone maintenance clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that people who are approaching this as drug testing for people on public assistance have got it all wrong. The bottom line is, would these people deny their brother or sister public assistance if they had cancer? Well, the reality is that addiction is a disease, and we have to recognize it for what it is.
Excellent point. Lenny, you have just made the most brilliant argument that I wish I had made when I was debating Jamie. You're absolutely right.
You know, there's just no way around it. You have to come to that conclusion. And until we stop, you know, putting a stigma on people who suffer from an illness, regardless of what that illness is, be it.
Right.
Be
and
it
regardless
HIV
what the source of their income is.
Addiction.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I am totally with you, and so well said. Thank you so much for calling and helping me the next time I debate this issue. I appreciate it. Kim in Chicago. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Hi, building on that last call, what is the plan after people are tested? Are they going to provide health care?
No, they just throw it. They just say you can't have any more money. Die in the street.
They're not going to arrest them or do anything about the information. They're just going to.
Well, it's not inconceivable they'd arrest them, but then you go from paying them $150 a week in housing and food assistance to $55,000 a year to put them in jail. I mean, it's insane.
In a corporate prison, yeah.
Right, yeah, it's insane. It is absolutely nuts. Thank you very much, Kim, for the call. Good point. Renee in Los Angeles. Hey, Renee, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I love your show.
Thank you.
I was just listening to all the right-wing pundits, and they were saying that they have Paul Ryan's budget, and they said the president doesn't have a budget.
Mm.
Does he have a budget?
The president does have a budget, yeah, and actually... He's going to be rolling out his budget over the next week or so, but the Progressive Caucus, the last 2 years in a row, has had a really great budget. The president hasn't endorsed it, but I do, and some 80-some-odd members of Congress have. I mean, there are a lot of alternatives to Paul Ryan's budget that really need to get out there. And the president has agreed to, as he pointed out in his speech the other day, to legislation. They actually nailed this down that at least through the end of the fiscal year and until the beginning of next year, I guess it is, past the elections, that cuts spending pretty radically. And, you know, it's just the only raising of taxes is letting the Reagan tax cuts expire, which is making the Republicans crazy. Renee, thanks for the call. We will be back tomorrow. It's Thursday. That means it's Geeky Science Rocks. And Dr. Samuel Gregg is going to come here and tell us that the left has a war on history. What? Yeah, it should be entertaining. And the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, where we occupy the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And don't forget, Democracy begins when you show up, when you get active, when you participate. Get out there and occupy something yourself. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.